Happy Father's Day. Father's Day is very quiet up here, isn't it? Not the traffic normally. Well, I'll start with a quote, the first of many. You will see this talk is really just a series of plagiarisms, and there's not an original thought in it. It's grabbed from all over. So this is from the Rinzai Roku, and it's, I think, appropriate for Father's Day and for the talk. Venerable ones, that's you guys. Time is precious, yet you run about hither and thither, studying Zen, learning the way, chasing names and phrases, seeking the Buddha and patriarchs and good teachers, full of arbitrary judgment. Do not commit such errors. Followers of the way, you each have a father and a mother. So what more do you seek? Turn round and look into yourselves. An old master said, Yajnadatta thought he had lost his head. When he ceased from his frantic looking for it, he had nothing further to seek. A couple months ago, I was at the prison with Doug, and he told here later a little story about this fellow Marcos, who he's been in the prison system for over 20 years, and maybe will be there all his life. That's what we speculate. And he's a very sincere practitioner, and he's kind of the head of his wing. They call him the MAC. They have acronyms for everything. And this was the first time I met him, and we had come there, and he was thanking us for coming, and he said that he felt unworthy that we, you know, should come there, and we exchanged a few things. Finally, I asked him, well, what would make you feel worthy? And he said, well, if when I got up in the morning, I felt my feet touch the ground. In other words, if he was practicing, you know, more diligently, I think. And I've thought a lot about that, both when the way he said unworthy and his head bowed and then his response, you know, in some ways that sounds right. So this just sort of led me to start thinking about this whole notion of self-worth and worth and value. And when I was asked to give a talk, I even more intensely started researching it. So here is the results. First is a quote from Coben. I think you can find this on Wikipedia. We sit to make life meaningful. The significance of our life is not experienced in striving to create some perfect thing. We must simply start with accepting ourselves. Sitting brings us back to actually who and where we are. This can be very painful. Self-acceptance is the hardest thing to do. If we can't accept ourselves, we are living in ignorance, this darkest night. We may still be awake, but we don't know where we are. We cannot see. The mind has no light. Practice is this candle in our very darkest room. I thought about the ways we go about looking for this worth, you know, the strategies we employ, because I think we all do that. And I sort of broke them down. And I think the most common one is acquisition, basically. We try to improve ourselves in some way or achieve status, being very power, wealth, status, be the CEO of some company. I won't spend a lot of time on that because probably none of you believe that's the way to go. If you do, you've come to the wrong place. Although everyone, I believe, falls into that, and even in Zen centers, it's a terrible waste of time to be seeking status in a Zen center, but it happens. There's a little analysis, a master-slave, the master-slave dialectic, and slaves, or maybe the workers now, they look up like to the CEOs and envy, right? Wish they could acquire that, be that. But the masters and the CEOs, they can't look to the slaves, workers, and they're in competition with their other masters and CEOs. So they, what did Bob Dylan say? I got nothing, Ma, to look up to. Their lives are always in a kind of battle, not so pleasant. We don't want to go that way. There's another acquisition. One more thing. A session here a little while ago, there was a trumpet player, and to show you how extensive this kind of status, just ubiquitous it is, musicians always have their jokes, and he told trumpet player jokes. This is how two trumpet players greet each other. Hi, I'm better than you. It's just one-upmanship. We all know about it, right? And it's never-ending, right? You can never win, you know. Even when you can only win momentarily, and then the doubts will start creeping in, and you'll see someone. Like when I go play at this place, and these drummers are just so far back, I feel very small, you know. And I know that's not where my worth comes from intellectually, but still, you know, it's ubiquitous. Well, the other very common acquisition is romantic love. If we could get this perfect partner, you know, then our lives would settle into place. And that's, you know, songs and poems and literature. Before I trash that, let me read something that really, you know, shows how strong and wonderful it is. This is from War and Peace, and it's right towards the end of the novel. And Pierre, he's been captured by Napoleon's army, he's escaped, he's had this epiphany, all sorts of trials and torments have occurred. But now he's on the verge of winning Natasha's love. And so here we go. He's talking to Princess Maria. He says, I know that she loves, will love you, Princess Maria corrected herself. Before her words were out, Pierre had sprung up and with a frightened expression seized Princess Maria's hands. What makes you think so? You think I may hope? You think? Yes, I think so, said Princess Maria with a smile. No, it cannot be. How happy I am. But it can't be. How happy I am. No, it can't be. Pierre kept saying as he kissed Princess Maria's hands. Next day, Pierre came to say goodbye. That day, as he looked at her, Pierre sometimes felt, this is at Natasha, as if he was vanishing, and that neither he nor she existed any longer, that nothing existed but happiness. Is it possible? No, it can't be, he told himself, every look, gesture, and word that filled his soul with joy. Is it possible that this hand, that face, those eyes, all this treasure of feminine charm, so strange to me now, is it possible that it will one day be mine forever? As familiar to me as I am to myself. No, that's impossible. Goodbye, Count, she said aloud. I shall look forward very much to your return, she added in a whisper. And these simple words, her look, and the expression on her face which accompanied them, formed for 2 months the subject of inexhaustible memories, interpretations, and happy meditations for Pierre. I shall look forward very much to your return. Yes, yes. How did she say it? Yes, I shall look forward very much to your return. Oh, how happy I am. What is happening to me? How happy I am, said Pierre to himself. A joyful, unexpected frenzy, of which he had thought himself incapable, possessed him. The whole meaning of life, not for him alone, but for the whole world, seemed to him centered in his love and the possibility of being loved by her. At times, everybody seemed to him to be occupied with one thing only, his future happiness. You ever felt that way? Sometimes it seemed to him that other people were all as pleased as he was himself and merely tried to hide that pleasure by pretending to be busy with other interests. In every word and gesture, he saw allusions to his happiness. He often surprised those he met by his significantly happy looks and smiles, which seemed to express a secret understanding between him and them. And when he realized that people might not be aware of his happiness, he pitied them with his whole heart and felt a desire somehow to explain to them that all that occupied them was a mere frivolous trifle, unworthy of attention. When it was suggested to him that he should enter the civil service, or when the war or any general political affairs were discussed on the assumption that everybody's welfare depended on this or that issue of events, he would listen with a mild and pitying smile and surprise people by his strange comments. But at this time he saw everybody, both those who, as he imagined, understood the real meaning of life, that is, what he was feeling, and those unfortunates who evidently did not understand it, in the bright light of the emotion that shone within himself, and at once, without any effort, saw in everyone he met everything that was good and worthy of being loved. Often, in later life, Pierre recalled this period of blissful madness. All the views he formed of men and circumstances at this time remained true for him always. He not only did not renounce them subsequently, but when he was in doubt, or inwardly at variance, he referred to the views he had held at this time of his madness, and they always proved correct. I may have appeared strange and queer then, he thought, but I was not so mad as I seemed. On the contrary, I was then wiser and had more insight than at any other time, and understood all that is worth understanding in life, because I was happy. Pierre's madness consisted in not waiting, as he used to do, to discover personal attributes, which he termed good qualities in people, before loving them. His heart was now overflowing with love, and by loving people without cause, he discovered indubitable causes for loving them. Is that great? That's why he's a great writer. Were bells ringing? I mean, we've all experienced some degree to this. And I think also in Zen practice, you can experience this, where many of the things he was referring. In fact, I know my teacher, we saw a movie, Falling in Love. It's a kind of forgettable film. Jack Nicholson and Meryl Streep, great actresses, but But when we came out, and he rarely would do any, like, teaching, kind of outside. But he said, falling in love and Zen mind, the same. Oh. Which I've always liked that, really. When you don't say much, unlike what I'm doing, it really sticks, right? But he was a master economist of words. So that sounds good, right? This sounds like the way to go. But listen to this. And this was a little earlier. It says, but only one terrible doubt sometimes crossed his mind. Wasn't it all a dream? Isn't Princess Maria mistaken? Am I not too conceited and self-confident? I believe all this. And suddenly Princess Maria will tell her, and she will be sure to smile and say, "How strange. He must be deluding himself. Doesn't he know that he is a man? Just a man, while I'm something altogether different and higher." I don't know where I heard this, and I tried to look it up, steal it again, but I had to make my own version. It was on a sitcom, and it's basically that love happens when two people, each of which feels inferior to the other, unite. So, because we look, you know, we want others, we sense that we are worthwhile, but we want others to recognize it. And then when you find this one person that recognizes it, then you're like brilliantly happy, right? This kind of, he says happy, but happy is almost a shallow word for it. He's fulfilled, you know, and his doubts are settled. But then it creeps back in, you know. And then, of course, has anyone ever fallen in love and fallen out of it here? Or had the person fall out of love that you were in love? It's not the most reliable way to go. because still, you're trying to find value, something outside that's contingent, that can come and go, and it can lead to much pain. There's another, excuse me, I have to keep this. I saw on the web 31 ways to know you're in the right relationship. The best relationships make you feel that you've convinced a person more exceptional than you to love you. And what kind of strategy is that? Go about tricking people into thinking you're someone better than you are. So that will never work. But yeah, still. Here, this a little quote, Hakuin from his song of Zazen. He says, "How near the truth, yet how far we seek, like someone in the midst of water crying out in thirst." All spiritual, religious, philosophical tradition, they are looking for something that you cannot doubt. Rinzai is always talking about settling all your doubts, you know. And romantic love, as wonderful as it is, it does come and go. And if it's not coming from you, if you're not the source, there are a number of traditions that take that loving consciousness that Tolstoy described so well, and then fix it on an ideal, like Platonic love. You see, fall in love with the beauty and the harmony, and beauty is a word in Platonism that goes beyond mere physical. It's just the rightness and virtue of something. And I think the Sufis, with their beloved Tantra, maybe somewhat chivalrous love, Bhakti Yoga. Now we're getting closer. You find, or as we say in the meditation, seducing love all through the world. Over the world. Or Browning's love for love's sake. I don't know that much about those other traditions, so I'm not going to say you investigate them. Some probably have. The Plato's idea of using love and a love of some love of wisdom and then love of virtue, it spins into a kind of a moral perfection. And now I will go to my first difficult topic. Kant, the philosopher, Immanuel Kant, a German, he felt that the one unquestioned source of value was the goodwill, that this could not be doubted, and it was the only absolute. He says, like happiness, okay, goodness of happiness is conditioned by the possession of a goodwill, which seems to constitute the indispensable condition of being even worthy of happiness. Again, that worthy. So that his idea is we don't want to see someone be rewarded for doing despicable acts. That your goodness should be commensurate with your happiness. He was a legal scholar as well. He has his argument, and we'll just run through it. I don't expect you to follow it all, but some of it will. We regard some of our ends as good, even though they're obviously conditional. There must be a condition of their goodness. Tracing back. A source of their value. We regard them as good whenever they are chosen with full rational autonomy. So full rational autonomy itself is the source of their value. Since this holds for other rational beings as well as myself, I cannot act against their rational autonomy without violating my own. And so it turns out to be a goodwill that is the source of all value. He's not as fine as Tolstoy as he is. But to kind of follow his line of thinking. Early Buddhism, Theravadin Buddhism, moral virtue is very highly regarded as part of the Eightfold Path. But I don't believe, at least the way I see it, that they view that as the end, that it's the source of value. It's part of the process. They have, if I can find it, there's a little, yes, what's the value of moral perfection? Now, most people usually say the virtue is its own reward, but in this little section, and I've seen this repeated before, it's freedom from remorse. So in some sense, that is, you shouldn't feel unworthy or shameful if you are morally upright. But then freedom from remorse then leads to joy, which leads to rapture, to tranquility, to happiness, to concentration, and vision and knowledge of reality, detachment, and finally deliverance. And there's ways you can look at it as a circle, or so in some ways all of them inform each other, and there is no beginning or end point. Often, moral sila is considered sort of a gateway into the practice and a precondition. Dogen was asked in the Bindawai, a series of questions, is it necessary for those who focus on this zazen to strictly observe the precepts? He says, maintaining the precepts is indeed the guiding rule and tradition, but even those who have not yet received precepts, or who have broken the precepts, still do not lack the possibility to practice zazen. And again, Hakuin in the same song about this, devotion, repentance, training, the many paramitas, all have their source in zazen. So, Sendri is sort of putting the source of value in zazen, not moral perfection, but if you paid attention to Dogen's words, were very carefully given. He didn't say it was unimportant or not of value. Kant, he has a sort of duty bound ethic, and if you have a duty towards moral perfection, but yet he acknowledges no one can achieve that. So how it seems, how can you this be demanded of you when it's unattainable? And he postulates immortality, I guess, a kind of like calculus that will eventually reach the limit of holiness if we can live long enough, and a God to write the kingdom of ends. That's not my particular belief system, so I'll continue. We will go to now Aristotle. You see, I'm stealing from everyone. Cross time. Aristotle disagreed with Kant. If you can disagree with someone who hasn't been born yet, he did not feel that that a moral to do something good, say for someone, like we say, save all sentient beings. Right? So I've heard people say that that's you should practice for others to save. You know, but what makes them worth saving? And what does saving consist of? So, moral actions, they have to have something worthwhile, some fundamental worth. You're doing them for a reason. You do virtue for its own sake, but still, it should have some end for some happiness or understanding. And Aristotle points out some ultimate source of value should be something that you would choose to be born for. Something so wonderful, you choose life. And not many of us would choose life just to fulfill our moral obligations. That sounds rather kind of dire. Almost, I don't know, an incarceration of some kind, not a joyful life. So he points to contemplation. You see, we're getting to what we're doing here eventually, roundabout. He says, contemplation is an activity that consists in understanding. We have understanding of something when we have grasped its essence, its nature. The best objects of contemplation are God, the final purpose of the world, and the heavens. Aristotle also believes that what God does is to contemplate, and that since God is the best thing, God must contemplate God. God is the activity of thinking on thinking, and the aim of the contemplative life is to engage in this divine activity. Does that remind you a little of Dogen, thinking on thinking? Isn't it interesting? This is why I do like to go back, and other people who saw it, they inform. You get, like, different perspectives. He says, the contemplative life is judged happiest, which happiness means something a little different in Aristotle than what I won't get into that, but mainly on the grounds that contemplation is the only activity that is loved for itself alone. So you would choose to come. There's more here. Anaxagoras, if I can find it. He asks, why would one choose to be born? Anaxagoras, he says that it would be in order to apprehend the heavens and the order in the whole universe. That's a very Greek response. For existence itself, in a sense, the wonder of existence, the wonder of life. Kant disagrees with this because he says that if contemplation is the end, contemplate the world. The world has to be worthwhile, worth contemplating. And how do you know that? Because we can't know the end, the purpose of the world. I will read you one curious response, and then we'll get into our own boys and how they answer that. Uh, Okay, so the world must have a final purpose in order to be worth contemplating. Aristotle could say, this is this guy speaking for him, which I guess you're allowed to do when he's no longer alive, we contemplate God, yet God is also a contemplator. And what God contemplates is God, for God is thinking on thinking. Thus, to the charge that contemplation cannot be the final purpose, because the world needs a final purpose in order to be worth contemplating, the answer would be both that the world has a final purpose, and it is worth contemplating, and that contemplation is that final purpose. QED. Aristotle thinks that we can participate in the final purpose of the world through contemplative activity. He also, I skipped over a little something, this notion of virtue or arete, they have this word, and it's what makes each thing its unique thing. It's like its power, its virtue is its power, its excellence, and for Aristotle, it's sometimes it's put as rational, that's his Greek, but it's also understanding. We would say prajna, our wisdom, which then leads to compassion. That is like our wondrous activity. Dogen from Vindhya. All Buddha Tathagatas together have been simply transmitting wondrous dharma and actualizing Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, incomparable awareness, for which there is no unsurpassable, unfabricated, wondrous method, for which there is an unsurpassable, unfabricated, wondrous method. So this incomparable awareness, that's a great phrase because both is sort of supreme, nothing to compare, but also you don't have to compare. Your zazen is your zazen. It's your unique, incomparable awareness. So, you know, you move this or you do that, it doesn't matter, you know. There is also this Aristotelian idea that I think jives well in Zen practice. He makes a distinction between a process and an activity. And a process is something you do for the sake of something else that has a termination point. Like you build a house to build a house. But an activity, you just do it for its own sake. Like you take a walk, you just take a walk. And an activity doesn't have like some end point, or at every point, you're taking a walk. So we do zazen at every point. You're just doing zazen. There's no end. Or as Dogen would say, the traces of enlightenment come to an end, and this traceless enlightenment is continued endlessly. So it's an ongoing practice activity. Some ways I think Zen practice is about turning all of our processes into activities. You know, we do that sometimes with rituals, with the Orioki. So you're not doing things for the result. You're doing them to engage in this wondrous dharma activity. And when you live that way, then there's real value, you know. Kant is correct in a way. He says that human beings are the source of value, not the world. But in our lineage, the distinction between the two is not so cut and dry. We bestow value to the world through our activity in it. And then the world enfolds back on us. In this Vindhya, Dogen talks about the self-fulfilling the self and the self-using the self. And the self and the world, they're just inextricably intertwined. It's curious that Kant, who made like enormous strides in this probably more than any other philosopher in showing how the world isn't something that's outside of us, but that our own mind actually creates it, what we perceive, not just colors and shapes and sound, but he even felt space and time were mental. So if you throw those in, what's left? But yet he didn't quite make this kind of leap, which I think is unique to Zen practice. I guess the bell isn't rung, so it's done it soon. We make the self into the self. We're actually engaged in the process. And how do you do that? So I hope I have time to read this one last. This is, again, from the Bindoa, and it's this koan. And he's asking a question, and then he tells this story. Long ago, Kensoku was the director monk in the assembly. Hogan asked him, "Director Kensoku, how long have you been in my assembly?" "Master, I have been here for 3 years." "You are a student. Why haven't you ever asked me about the Buddha Dharma?" Kensoku said, "I cannot deceive you, O teacher. Once when I was Zen Master's Seho's place, I realized the peace and joy of Buddha Dharma." Hogan asked, "With which words were you able to enter?" Kensoku responded, "I once asked Seho, what is the self of the student?" "My own self." Seho said, "The fire boy comes seeking fire." Hogan said, "Good words. However, I'm afraid you do not really understand them." Gensoku said, "My understanding is that the fire boy belongs to fire. Already fire, still he seeks fire, just like being self and seeking self." Like Yajna Dada looking for his head. Hogan exclaimed, "Now I really know that you don't understand." If Buddha Dharma was like that, it would not have been transmitted up today. At this, Kensoku was overwrought and immediately left. On the road, he thought, "The master is one of the world's fine teachers, and also the guiding teacher of 500 people. Certainly there must be merit in his pointing out my error." He returned to Hogan, and after doing prostrations and repentance, asked, "What is the self of this student?" Hogan said, "The fire boy comes seeking fire." Got it? With these words, Kensoku was greatly enlightened to Buddha Dharma. And fortunately, there's a little note by Uchiyama Roshi. He says, "Hogan's response emphasizes the necessity of the actual seeking of the self for the self." This is the very subtle part, because we're often told not to strive, not to seek. Mm-hmm. And yet, but we do have to seek. But the seeking, it's like you and Holly have taken a bird watching, is that right?
A little bit.
Yeah, so you go out and, if you went out like Yajna Dada, frantically, see, let's find as many birds as we can and run through the woods. How many? How many you got? They all take off. But you move quietly. And you have to see. You have to look through all the leaves. And you see them, but you're also, And what you couldn't see before, after some time, suddenly you see. It's revealed. So it's that kind of seeking that I think he's pointing at. And that is our genius. That is our virtue, the actual seeking. That's why a practice and enlightenment can be the same thing. They're one. It's the actual seeking of the self for the self, the looking at it, and this God contemplating God. Because in our tradition, we are the Buddha. We create the world. We create it We contemplate it. We take joy in self-discovery. It's not a practice of, you know, getting all uptight about getting it right. That, you know, you see that happen. So when we get mad, you know, sometimes that's. But the real treasure of it is something that anyone can do. Just look. You know, you sit and you look. Just this ongoing seeking, that's wonderful enough, because things will be revealed. One last. And we do have to keep coming back to it, because our minds do get clouded from all, don't be deceived by others. We're constantly bombarded with all these messages. You know, like, you need a new car, or I don't know, a new hairdo, or something, you know, or you need to get better, you know, at whatever it is, you know. And you go out, and the dusty world, right? It's not that the world is bad, but there's all kinds of attachments that happen, and we have to spend that time. We come here, or you sit and practice, uncover. It's an uncovering. It's a rediscovery. Oh, this is wonderful. The Arabic word, I guess, for human being means one who forgets. Is that great? So it's a remembering. We come here, we remember who we are. We rediscover who we are. Then we go back out and get lost again. Then come back. You know, it's just, that's how it is. Explaining this idea of, you know, how we're intrinsically pure. But he says, thus, the essence of mind, all things are intrinsically pure. Like the azure of the sky and the radiance of the sun and the moon, which when obscured by passing clouds may appear as if their brightness has been dimmed. But as soon as the clouds are blown away, brightness reappears and all objects are fully illuminated. Bankei, he, over and over, his whole message is just your mind is marvelously illuminating. And you have nothing other to attain than just to realize your marvelously illuminating mind, which you do moment by moment. You hear the bell, you hear those birds, you see the trees, that's all. Ordinary mind is the marvelously illuminating mind. Any questions? Good. We can eat because I'm hungry.
Any questions?
Since I'm a stranger here, it helps me ask a question. when you talk about love and Buddhism, I think of love typically results in these vows. We make marriage vows. In Buddhism, we make a vow somehow that we will make some kind of effort, or that there's some consistency. And those vows are, I don't know if you would call them unconditioned or impermanent or permanent or whatever, but it seems like there's something that doesn't just happen in a Taoist sense, that because as humans we put people in prison and we, you know, can destroy the environment and we can be violent to each other with the words that we say. And somehow there's a vow, it's a place for a vow. And I don't know what is a vow. I mean, what it really is this, you know, you've been able to talk about these things without talking about the vow that somehow is gave rise to or somehow participated in making Buddhism different from other things and a marriage different from a relationship, for example. So someone asked you, do you have a sense of what God is?
I guess for me, it's like a real deep intention, and I'm going to do this. I'm going to try as much as I can. But it also requires understanding. I think you come to a real vow when you come to an understanding of the situation, what you have been doing, you know, not just, I'm going to do this because, you know, it's in the Ten Commandments or in the precepts or... It requires, it, well, like what Hakuin said, that Zazen is the source of all, even paramitas, even vows, understanding, you know. When he says Zazen, it's Zazen Samadhi. It's Hui Ning talks about understanding, or prajna, and Samadhi, concentration, are one. One doesn't beget the other. They're the same. They happen both together instantaneously. When deep samadhi is understanding. And deep understanding will bring you to, they use the Aristotelian word again, virtue, aristeia, excellence. You see that at this moment you're sitting, there's a kind of perfection. You can feel a perfection, and there will be a vow to sustain that and to bring it into more and more your life. You will fail because we're only human, you know. But that's okay. Then you just come back, you know. And does that...
You talk about like in sitting, like there's a moment of perfection, and then like in life, I like the word you used before, like there's this calculus of like approaching perfection all the time.
Oh, that was, yeah, the Kant's notion.
So there's like these two notions of perfection, like momentary perfection, and then like time bound perfection. I mean, what's the meaning? And like the time bound one seems like it's like agony. It's like,
yeah.
How much time do we need for, you know?
Yeah, forever. You need forever. That's all.
But you can't, you can't stop trying somehow?
No, you can't. Right. And that's like the human dilemma. And that's sort of the problem, I think, with going that route. But Zen is always perfect. You're perfect right now. You just need to see it. Yeah. We're perfect as we are. Everything is perfect as it is. It's only the birds are always there. There's hundreds of birds out there. I can't see any of them because I'm not looking, you know. Now you can blame yourself, you know, and get into all that kind of nonsense if you want to. I don't want to do that. So it's just coming, sitting, simple, breath by breath. Moment by moment, you make a vow in that way. I'm going to look. I'm going to uncover. I'm going to watch whatever, you know. Sometimes it's as simple as I'm going to watch my legs on the floor. I'm going to watch my body. I'm going to be erect.